Why is it we humans get romanced by complexity when the answers can be found at a simple and practical level? This is the Simply Practically Human podcast, where the human manager, Mark Labasque, features experts who have a track record in humanizing workplaces, using simplicity and practicality as their go-to approach. It's all about getting back to what it is to be human and watch workplaces thrive rather than just survive.
Hey there, fellow humans. Mark Labusky here for the Simply Practically Human podcast. And my guest this week was the co-founder of 10,000 Hours, Marcus Crowe, who's based in Sydney. And I've been a bit fascinated with reading some of Marcus's great work on LinkedIn, and just got a sense that he's someone who's, I guess, over his 25 years of consulting in leadership and the training and all those sorts of things that he's helped many organizations with around the world, he's got some quite strong views around the world of work and particularly change. And today we're going to delve into this idea of, you know, the conundrum of continuity or change. And even in the change we see today, is it really just continuity playing out in a different way? And, you know, is it just putting lipstick on the pig rather than getting into some real fundamental and necessary change? Really great backstory that Marcus shared. He says a few times he was lucky. I'm not sure that that luck played into where he's got himself to today. He's a very, very deep thinker about a whole lot of things, one of them being leadership, the world of work, why change isn't particularly happening as it should, and perhaps even why we try and masquerade continuity as change when really, if we think about some things that were around 30, 40, 50 years ago, they're still with us today, but perhaps just in another form, but we say we've changed. I think you're going to pick up some high-level concepts from our conversation today. As I said, Marcus is someone that can work at both the helicopter level, but also can get down in amongst the weeds and share some really, really interesting examples today of what can happen, the unintended consequences of when we bring a change in, but we haven't really thought of the consequences, or we haven't really communicated the consequences well across the whole audience. So we'll share some things about that today. Sit back, have a listen. I would really encourage you to reach out and connect with Marcus on LinkedIn. He made a very generous offer. He loves to have conversations with other humans. Take some notes. I'm sure once you've done that, you'll be reaching out to him. We'll catch you at the end. Delighted to be joined this week by co-founder of 10,000 Hours, Marcus Crowe. Marcus, thanks for joining me.
Mark, thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Mate, I always sort of think about how I introduce people, and it really hasn't given justice to what you have done and the way you describe yourself. I'm going to come to that in a minute, but I always get people to talk about how we connected, but I reckon I reached out to you because I started reading some of your material on LinkedIn, which was just like, this guy gets it. This is fascinating. And we're going to sort of delve into a little bit of some of what I call your provocative nature, but done for a great reason today. Mm-hmm. But before we get there, talk a bit more about your background, if you wouldn't mind, about you as the human being, because there's so much richness in your profile that I couldn't do justice to then.
Well, where do you start an answer to a question like that? Look, I've had a very fortunate life, you might say, lived a happy childhood, for want of a term. All good all the way through those formative years, you might say. And so at the career level, I suppose at some point you've got to say, stop saying I have a background in, and say, actually what I do is this group facilitation, executive education, consulting work. I fell into it at a really relatively young age for the industry, which was about 25. And that was down to a lucky break and a bit of brassy confidence. So I sort of got a lucky break into some presentation skills, training work as a young, cheap, energetic resource for a company that was then known as Rogen, which became known as Rogen SI in the latter years, and even Teletech, and then something else after that. And that was where I got my start. And oddly enough, the Olympics being on at the moment, the Sydney Olympics were in construction at that point, late 90s. And the break I got was that they needed someone to train presentation skills to a whole bunch of Sydney organising committee staff because they'd done a sponsorship for a value in kind for services. And of course, the best way to make good on that is put the cheapest thing you can find on it, which was me. So very fortunately, they said, go out to SOCOG and run presentation skills. So I did other things around that, but that was a large part of what I did do. And it was a great way to learn organizational life. I think it's the consultant's position is a privileged one because you get this vicarious exposure to all these different companies and industries. And I think, you know, other people just, you know, they don't get around as much as the way a consultant can. So I've been very lucky and I enjoy it.
Yeah, it's interesting using the word luck. My sense is there's a bit more involved than luck. But so there was Rogin. Then you went out and created like a really, really successful organization before you've sort of co-founded 10,000 Hours. What was that business?
Well, that business was, funnily enough, it was originally called Speakers International. It was the Australian arm of the English company, which they then decided to back away from. And my colleague at the time, because we were employees of an Australian company that was wholly owned by an English parent, we looked at each other and we could see that we'd been busy trying to get something going. And it had been a slow start and took a while to kick along, but we could see the forward order book. So we went from being employees of an Australian company owned by an English one to being co-founders and owners of an Australian company almost overnight, from one Friday when we changed the entity to the next Monday. I was very lucky with co-founders. I have been in my whole career. So Gavin and Ben and myself, so the three of us who were part of what became known as Oxygen Learning. And then we had a trademark conflict. It was a good lesson in protecting your intellectual property. So that meant we had to change our name. We changed our name to Fuel. So many of your listeners may have heard of Fuel. And so I was one of the three founders and all of us have moved on since those lovely days looking back. And that business was sold to what was then known as STW, which was at that point John Singleton's yep. listed vehicle. And again, he's moved on and the name's changed again and it's now called WPP, I think. So, you know, one of the things, funny enough, what we're talking about is, you know, here I am telling stories that are only sort of 10 and 15 years old, but already the references, the labels, the names, the entities, they've all changed. They've all drifted into different things and the remnants of them are still there. But of course, they're now owned in different ways or described in different ways.
Yeah, and we're going to get into change and continuity today. There was one other thing I picked up in your LinkedIn profile that I was extremely curious about was your involvement with Mensa.
Yes. Yeah, it's great. I must confess, in recent years, I haven't been as involved. But in sort of medium-term history, I got involved volunteering with their testing process. So one Saturday every month, we used to have a room down at UTS in Broadway. And anyone, and this still happens today, actually, I'm not confident of where the venue is, but you could find out, where if you believe you could earn your way into the organisation, which for those many of you will know that, you know, it's the so-called high IQ organisation, which measures fluid intelligence and at a threshold of the 98th percentile. And so all these lovely people from all over the landscape would turn up to this test on a Saturday. It's an interesting test because it's deliberately aggressive in that it's timed. So it's quite long in most contexts. And so therefore you're almost not meant to finish it, but it's a case of how far through did you get in the time window allowed and how accurate were you with your answers. So it's speed and accuracy under time pressure. And I've met some fascinating people through my involvement there. It really and truly, some, as you can imagine, some very interesting minds from all kinds of eclectic backgrounds and occupations.
Yeah, as soon as I read that, I actually had this horrible feeling that I'm going to be getting on to interview someone that, and I think you are anyway, is a hell of a lot more intelligent than me. And I was starting to shit myself a bit and go, I'm in a bit of trouble here. So I better make sure that at least I come across as someone that's half intelligent.
No worries at all.
we've had one conversation before this where we caught up and we had a bit of a chat about a whole lot of things in the world. And then it was a bit like earlier in the week, hey, Marcus, what do you reckon about the topic? And you had picked up something that I'd responded, I think, to Dominic Price, I think his name is. It was around some surveying and some research have been done linking into the Great Resignation. This idea now that everything's going to change because of the pandemic and whatnot. And you sort of said, why don't we jump in there? So, like today, I do really want to explore this thing that I talk to people about, which is I say to them that the very people who are espousing change seem to be the same ones who are trying to keep everything the same or keep things in continuity. Mm. So I'm going to play around a bit with that today. And I want to start by getting your view around, you know, there is all this talk, the optimism, I'm going to say, of the pandemic and what can come out the other side of it. And there's the great resignation, hybrid working, there's flexible working. This will be the time that everything changes. There's a groundswell of optimism. What's usually been the historical realism of these events, like a GFC or something like that?
Well, I mean, there's people far better qualified to give you sort of, you know, thorough economic history reflections. I can only, you know, give you what I've noticed in you know, in my small corner of the world and career. I think management narrative is in love with the idea of the great new thing that's coming. There's a breathlessness to the narrative that, you know, are you ready for digital disruption? And, oh my God, are you ready for, I mean, look at the label, the great resignation. It conjures images almost of like those nature documentaries where you see the migration patterns of entire species galloping across the savannah, or, you know, this idea that there's this great, you know, throng of movement and surge. And I think the lived experience is just a lot less spectacular and dramatic. No doubt there'll be some people who will resign when things settle down. And I would imagine, no doubt, there'll be some people who will just happily carry on. And we won't ever actually go back and check, was there a great resignation? I mean, you might find there'll be more resignations seasonally because perhaps during this thing, there were less, right? So you might go, okay, well, over a 12-month period, the number's probably the same.
Yep.
But across the 3 months when, I don't know, when you decide it's over, then maybe a year's worth of resigning will play out in 3 months. Now, that's not a great resignation. That's just 12 months of activity compressed into three.
I liked it when you said that it won't really happen that people will go back and check. Well, some people might, but building this thing up, I love you. It's grand. It's great. It's whatever it might be. What's sitting behind the use of that sort of language here, do you think, for those people that are building this up into what they maybe hope it's going to be or whatever? Why such bold language?
Well, I sometimes wonder if it's because actually the ordinary activities of businesses is quite reasonably dull.
Yeah.
Right? It's repetitive. I mean, if you think about, you know, Warren Buffett has a lovely line in one of his letters to shareholders where he says, look, a great investment manager has a lot in common with a sloth. You know, the point being, we sort of wake up, we look around, check to see things are kind of where they should be, and then we go back to bed.
Yep.
Because we've picked such great investments that we just want to get out of their way and let their performance and compounding do its thing over time. And I think he makes a really interesting point about, you know, a great business, picture of a regular non-pandemic world, but you come in the morning and you unlock the door and you switch the lights on and you fire up the assets that generate the return that the business is about, whether that's a half a dozen chairs for haircuts or whether that's three printing presses for brochures or whether that's a bunch of designers churning out digital design. I mean, whatever it is, the business does something and you fire up that engine that does all that work. And, you know, you have lunch together and you pay the wages on the middle of the month and you pay your insurances and you lock the door at night and you come back tomorrow and do it again. You know, and if you actually look at people who run businesses, they go, yeah, that's what we do. And so I think that's quite boring, really,
yeah,
by itself. And so to talk about it, you've actually got to ham it up a bit. You've got to add drama and controversy and amp up the hyperbole to make it sound like there's spectacular things going on when really, you know, it rolls along. And occasionally there's an event and we kind of look at that event and go, well, that was an interesting day on the markets or whatever it was. But it's beautifully mundane.
Yeah, I love it. Beautifully mundane. It's building it up. It's almost like people are hoping that something's going to change. But for change to occur, we need people to step into the risk that comes with that, because with any change that happens, they talk about humans being change resistant. I wonder if it's not more about what we're going to lose in that change. And then I think about how is it that the GFC didn't absolutely create the change that was going to happen. And look, there's hope that the pandemic might create this change. But in essence, I wonder if in all of the, let's call it the time of optimism right now, where we are forgetting about the old system, the old system that has been around for a while, that I'm going to tell you won't give up its place as easily as people might think it will. You know, out with the old, in with the new. Mm. What have you noticed? Because you've been in this game working, as you said, the vicarious nature of the work you've done and working with so many organisations. How have you seen the system bounce back? Because it does bounce back pretty well, but it picks its time as well to regain its rightful spot. Because I think at the moment it's hiding in the shadows a bit, but it's going to come back. How have you seen the system come back, I guess, relating to the way people behave?
But see, it's interesting, even the language in your question, right? So, Mark, if you go, it's hiding a bit, like what's the it in that sentence that you said? You know, what is it that you're actually describing? Like if you try and tease that out, and I don't know, can you? Like what is it that's this thing that we're referring to?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Good question. I'm on the other end of the bloody interview here now, but I'm going to have a crack at this. I love that. Thank you very much, Marcus. It is the back-to-back meetings. It is the need you in the office. It's the bell curve. It's all of these things that we've used along the way that, you know, we're going to change this. You know, we can work more from home now, or we're not going to rate people like this, but it just sneaks its way back in. So I guess it refers to, I'm going to call it, some of the older management practices that we keep talking about wanting to remove or to adapt in a more human world, but they tend to find their way back into their, what they call their rightful place.
Well, okay. So as you say, management practices or so-called old ones is an old management practice, a Bundy clock, right? So the idea that you would pick that card out. And I, as a young kid, I worked in a car air conditioning and car audio place as a school job, school holiday job. And they had one, you know, where you literally, you know, put the card in the top and it would stamp the time and date on there. And then you'd stick it in your slot and you were there for the day until the end of the day. Now we sort of go, oh, what an outdated management practice, right? We'll dismiss that and go, oh my, that's horrendous. How could you possibly have that? And yet have a look at the Microsoft suite now and, you know, Microsoft Teams, and you can tell if you're in front of your camera. I mean, for God's sake, there's a camera on us now all day while we work, and none of us even notice it. If there'd been a camera on me as I went about sweeping up the warehouse of the car air conditioning and car audio mess of the day, which was one of my little jobs to do, I mean, I would have thought, what are you doing? Why you put a camera on me? But I mean, there's a camera on us now.
Yep.
We're probably more surveilled now than we were then. And so to your point, you'll go, have we done out with the old management practice of Bundy clocks? Well, superficially, you might say, yes, we have. That technology has gone. And yet, if you really look at how we're living, that technology is not only alive and well, but I'm not even sure why it's called the Bundy clock. Is it named after the manufacturer or the, I don't
not
know.
Sure.
Let's imagine there's a guy called Joe Bundy who I don't know if there is. Joe, if you're out there, or the son or daughter, let us know. But, you know, if it was invented, they'd be applauding Microsoft Teams. They'd go, that's fantastic, because you can see when they're at their desk. You can see what they're looking at. You can tell if they're watching the web page or if they're watching another application. And, you know, this is magnificent data. So, you know, management has always needed to do some level of surveillance. And I think that practice, to your point, hasn't gone anywhere. It just looks, it's probably in a nicer box. It's a bit prettier and maybe even a little bit harder to even tell that it's there, but it's there.
I like that, harder to tell that it's there. I also wonder this, that what if people know it's still there? Because you've just described it beautifully. In fact, it's there in a different form and maybe a more intrusive form. What about those people who like to, I guess they'll sit there and go, well, it's not there because that was a Bundy clock and this is useful technology we've got now. So we're still doing the same things, but they're trying to bundle it up as a, let's call it, it's a new stick of lipstick on the pig at the moment. So what about those people that are like, you know, we could put any coloured lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. This is my point here, is that it is continuing, although people are putting it under the realm of significant change. Why do they do that? Why are people trying to hide that we're still doing the same stuff, but we're just wrapping it up in a different way?
Well, I'm still loving the colourful metaphor, right, of the lipstick. So you might say, if you sell pigs, if that's your business, not to overwork the metaphor, well, we've got to keep wrapping it up in a different way. You know, I mean, a good example of that, I think, is Christmas albums.
Yep.
Right. You know, they roll around, and as we grew up, they were, you know, records and CDs. And look, there's only so many Christmas songs more or less. I mean, I know a new one comes out now and then, but you go, it's the same offering. We just kind of dress it up a bit each year. So if you say, what's timeless about management or leadership, and get caught up in that debate, but is to go, I need you to allocate capital and coordinate labor. That's the job. So take the pile of money that the owners have given you and allocate it. Put it out to the things you know, buy the projects and spend it on the things you think you should spend it on. And then coordinate the labor, because you're going to need help. So get the other people and then figure out what they should do, right? So you go, that's the job. And then you go, here's two tools. I want you to predict the future. So tell me what's going to happen. And then I want you to control the process of getting there. So you say, okay, there's two jobs, allocate capital, coordinate label. There's two tools, prediction and control. Now, that's what's not changing, right? So that's coming through time. So much as you like to pretend Henry Ford and Fred Taylor are a thing of the past, they were doing it, and so are modern day management.
Yep.
Except what we're doing, to go back to the lipstick, is to go, why don't we call it something else? Let's call it agile. Let's call it daily stand-up. Let's call it holacracy. And that'll get howls of protest from some, I imagine, because they'll go, no, that's a fundamentally different way of working. But in the end, it's still there to say, I've got to coordinate this labor and I've got to have some level of control over what is happening. So there are these, you know, guilds and squads and this lovely tortured language that seems to get invented. Because I guess once you've used up team and group, you've got to go to new labels, right? Because it still just means subsets of populations of people. Does that make sense? They're just new labels.
Oh, mate, no, absolutely. Like, it's what, as you were talking, I was just, all I was seeing in front of me was a range of multiple shades of lipstick. But one pig sitting next to it and just sitting there confused looking, what colour are you going to put on me today? You know, when you just like agile and stand-ups and all of this stuff that's going on, they are just new terms for the continuity of the work. And that's not to say that, I'm not saying that some of that work that's being done isn't useful, because it's very useful. I think the management systems are useful. My sense is that we should be a little bit more honest about it with people. And, you know, when we get into change, I know what happens, because I've been in these rooms where it's like, hey, we need to get this change through, Marcus. Let's sit here and we'll come up with a fancy corporate wank statement that we'll then we'll roll out to the people. So it sort of won't offend them too much. They won't feel like they're losing too much, and we just hope they buy it. And it could be in the form of new language, or we're going to restructure, or we're going to, you know, resizing or whatever else we're going to do. Mm. But the thing with human beings, mate, is they've got good bullshit detectors.
So very good. Yeah, very
the
good.
Moment that we start to do that sort of stuff, what amazes me, and this is sort of going all over the place, but what amazes me is, why do we get sucked in? If me and you were running that change program, why do we get sucked in that people are going to buy the bullshit and think real change is coming, when what they really know is it's, we're going to continue to do the same thing, but we're just going to call it something different? Why do humans think they can push that stuff through?
I don't know. I mean, I wonder whether there's just a desire to wrap it in something kind of appealing, right? You go, look, we're going to install a new ERP system, you know, an SAP, an Oracle, one of those, right? So it's a big spend. And we've got old computer systems that are outdated and we need a new one. So you go, that's a reasonable thing to say, right? You go, yep, the old one's just not coping. We need a new one. But of course, then once you peel that cover back, you then go, oh, and if we're going to fix that, we're going to need to fix this, and then we're going to have to change the HR system because that won't work with payroll, but then that's going to clash with the debtors and the receiver. So, you know, you can imagine those things, they just keep, you know, becoming enormous. And, you know, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, you know, we did an ERP implementation and it was flawless and it was on time and it was under budget. And I think that's perfectly reasonable and to be expected, such is the unwieldy nature of that work. But so then you might say, well, we'll wrap it up with a campaign sticker, you know, and I think politics is instructive for management, right? Because you go, you know, if you're going to run for president, I mean, what was Barack Obama's original strapline? I mean, yes, we can.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, right? Because it's hopeful, it's short, it's pithy, like it's easy to say, and even, you know, make America great again. I mean, that's clever as well, right? These are clever people who come up with these things. And in the end, it's still just going, it's the same underneath. I mean, leaving aside the political ideology in that example, but you know, so a new manager has to come in and say, how do I, you know, what lipstick will I use? I've got to get attention. They're busy. They're distracted. They've seen some version of this game before. I mean, we've all colleagues. I've got a mate who works for a, you know, a major multinational that everybody would know the name. And he said, look, I've been there 8 years and I've had seven different leaders come through.
Yep.
You know, and he and his engineering mates, they stand at the back of the room, so to speak, or these days on the back of the Teams call and, you know, with their arms crossed sort of, and they're sending private messages to each other while the new boss is, you know, describing the vision. Frankly, while the new boss is unveiling the shade of lipstick that,
yep,
that they're there to announce. And I guess it would be a brave manager to say, hi, guys, I'm new and we're going to do a few different things and we're going to do a lot of what we've always done. I'm going to use different labels to describe the same stuff you've always been doing before. I'd like you to get excited about it, but I understand that some of you won't. And let's have a drink at Christmas. You know, like it would be a brave, adventurous leader who came in with that kind of raw, honest candor about what's really happening.
I love that. I love that you've gone there because I was just going to, given you, again, your experience with working with so many different organizations, why haven't we got more of those sorts of leaders that you just described? Because I think they've got a place, an important place in the future of work.
I think it comes across as cynicism and therefore it's probably not palatable overall. I think, yep, if you catch them on a quiet moment, you know, backstage, off the record, so to speak, I've had plenty of them say to me, look, Marcus, you know how this shit works. I've got to do this because it's got to look like that and I need it to look like this and I'm going to announce it in this way, but really it's this under the bonnet. And, you know, and this is where, you know, that line, you know, it's what did Shakespeare say, you know, it's all show business or some, yep, version of that, right? Yeah, there is a performative element to the theatre of organisational life, right? So there is an element of how we announce things and how we dress things up to create a sense of occasion and or a sense of a point in time, you know, before this we were that, but from this point on we'll be this new good thing. You know, yeah. And I think that's inevitable, right? And necessary.
I think theatre is a good thing. As you said, theatre, I was then thinking, so on the stage is the exec, it might be the CEO, and the exec are on the stage and they're performing the act that you talked about. You know, they're putting on the show. Hmm. What do you reckon, if you think back over the last 10 to 20 years, let's now think about the audience there that are watching the show, and they've seen the show a few times, by the way, because you said there could have been six or seven CEOs in that time. Hmm. When they had to write in the local newsletter about the performance that they saw on the stage, they had to critique it. What do you reckon most of the people in the audience would say when they were watching that show?
How new to their career are they in the audience? Is it an audience of grads or is it
what 15, a great question.
15, so, 15, look, 25 year veterans?
Let's work through that because I think you've just opened up a really big door here. Let's start with the grads.
Well, I remember being quite crestfallen when I went to my first company offsite, if you like. And, you know, as lots of, well, I don't know, maybe it's not true these days, but certainly, you know, you're young and you can't believe that someone's putting on this veritable party. That's what it feels like. It's a party with a presentation in the afternoon sort of thing, you know, and there's this lovely dinner and, you know, these were glory, you know, 90s days, I suppose. And I was listening to the then managing director of this business going through the, here's what's coming and here's how we've done. And it was good times. We'd hit the number and we were growing and, you know, life was good. And one of the seasoned operators who's probably 10 years older than me was standing next to me nursing his glass of red wine. I remember it distinctly. And he said, same shit, different day. I've heard this before. And I was crestfallen because I hadn't heard it before. And I thought it was all very exciting. I thought, this is great. This is, you know, we're going places and all these plans and new offices and career opportunities to go and open up the new offices. And I remember, I didn't quiz him at the time. I wish I had. I wasn't smart enough or wise enough, but being quite sad about the fact that, oh, you know, a bit like finding out Santa Claus is mum and dad, you know, you're sort of going,
yeah,
you're going, oh, really? Does he say that every year, does he? Because it sounded like he just said it just this year. And I'm really excited by it, but you've now made me think maybe I'm an idiot for believing it. And so that's why I wonder whether, you know, today's graduate, and I think the difference is today's graduate has so much more media access and,
yeah,
you know, like infinitely more access to the world. And so therefore can calibrate things far better.
This is an interesting situation. Yeah, and it could, in continuity and change here, the theme, but you've got Marcus standing next to the 10-year in the business person or 10 years old or whatever it might be, and they've deflated your tyres. I can remember that myself, mate, going to those sorts of things as a younger guy and just going, this is like super exciting. This is the place I want to be for the rest of my life. And then slowly over time, just I think chiseling away as it's like, hey, hang on, that's a little bit, it's sort of like what we talked about last year, but maybe a little bit of a different message and then the same again and it's going to change and then it starts to wear you down. The ability for organisations to make change without using some sort of lipstick to make change real and exciting and achievable, what's the secret sauce there to if you're talking to your clients and you're going, hey, you're going to do some change, but let's not do what we usually do. Let's make it real and achievable and people will get on board. What should they be thinking about from a communication perspective and even from the way that they behave themselves?
Well, I think one of the first questions is how inevitable and necessary is the change?
Yep.
So sometimes it's forced upon you in the way that you're going, look, if we don't do this, because I often say, you know, create a burning platform and use that lovely metaphor, which is very, you know, it's been a very enduring one. And sometimes the burning platform is legitimate in that you go, if we leave this how this is, it will die in this period of time. And I remember a telco client, and this guy, Simon, was phenomenal. He came in and he said he just had one chart, a line graph, and he had it printed out on like foam core, like about the size of a surfboard. And he just held it up on, he put it on his lap and he said, look, here is the average revenue we receive from the hardware in our network. So for base stations in 2G mobile phone networks. He said, here's the average margin we are receiving on that business. And here's the average HR cost of employing all of you. And the two lines hadn't yet intersected at the point in time that was now. But he said, look how where time goes, where eventually we're going to make so little money from 2G. In fact, there'll be no money in it and nobody will be in it. And plus the cost of you is horrendous. Because you guys keep going up in cost every year. So we need to be different. And what he was saying was, we need to do 3G and I need you to learn it. I need you to give me the Saturday mornings that you're going to use to learn the technology. I'll give you the training and I'll teach you, but I need you to do it on a Saturday. And then we're going to transition ourselves into a 3G outfit because that's where it's going to go next. I just thought it was so refreshing and it played really well. Very engineering audience, you know, very technical, practical kinds of people. And they just said, just appreciated his no bullshit approach. He said, here you go. This is where we are. And I always tell that story because I go, what's your equivalent line graph that says, if we do nothing, here's the problem. And it's a meaningful problem that has, you know, significant consequences for maybe some of us or all of us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And look, the other thing is like it was real. When I'm listening to you saying it's like, this is real. I'm actually going to outline for you people, this is what it looks like and this is why we need to do it. Rather than, you know, I'll give you an example the other way, hot desking.
Yeah.
So, you know why we're going to hot desk? Me and you are standing in the meeting and we're doing a stand up and all that sort of stuff. And we're going to hot desk because we want people to collaborate more. And we want people to meet people that they don't know. And, you know, you're gonna get to know more about Marcus because you don't see much Mark. And I'm standing there, my bullshit detectors are going nuts at this point in time. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? You just want to fucking reduce your real estate footprint. So why don't you tell me that? Because if you told me that here's the real estate line and here's where that's going and here's our cost of labor and all these sorts of things, and at some point in time there's an intersect here that isn't good for human beings, what we're going to be doing is we're doing this because we want to actually reduce our real estate cost, because if we don't, we're going to have to reduce our labor cost. But we wrap stuff up, and to me, if I think back to continuity, the continuity of the bullshit story. You know, maybe I'm naive, I don't know, but at what point in time are we just going to fess up and go, you know, the only constant in the world now is change. That's another line that gets rolled out. It's like, what? When are we going to say, what I'm trying to do here, Marcus, by making this change is to protect jobs or protect human beings and keep them in work, in meaningful work, rather than I'm actually just want you to get to know Mark better, but really I'm doing it for another reason. Why do we keep doing that?
I mean, I think you've got a great example of how uncomfortable it is to be candid about the fact that we are trying to trim our occupancy cost. And yet, you know, there would be a graph you could generate that would say, here's the average cost, you know, the cost of renting out this magnificent building in this beautiful part of town. And, you know, to even to have the data and say, look, we notice that on any given day, there's only 2/3 of you in the building for a whole host of reasons. There's annual leave and sick leave and client assignments and secondments. And we've realized that we have, you know, maybe 1.5 times the amount of space that we maybe actually need. We've been looking at this rise of this activity-based working, or hot desking as it's popularly known, and we've decided to go down that track. And we think it's good because it'll save us this amount on our rent bill. We'd rather have talented people like yourselves than gorgeous desks that are empty. And then, of course, you need to speak to the casualties in the process and say, so for some of you, this is going to be irritating. For those of you that really enjoy having your space, and, you know, and I've seen some lovely workarounds. When I met some guys, some sales guys in one of the banks, they were so pissed off at the new regime of hot desking that what he did was get an inter-office internal mail envelope, you know, a big one. It's the size of a letter laptop would slide into, or a manila folder. And he would just take up his desk's content for the day, put it into that envelope and write his own name on it, and then put it into internal mail. And so when he arrived the next day, he'd say, you deliver me my fucking stuff. I'm not putting it in a locker. You bring it back to me. You find where I am and you put it there. And so the volume that went up into internal mail skyrocketed because everybody caught onto this and said, yeah, I'll do that too. It was such a gorgeous protest because he was like, I'm not walking back to my locker. You've made me sit 3 floors away from where you put my locker because I arrived late because I did school drop-off. So by the time I got here, all the good desks were taken. So I had to be, you know, 4 floors away. I met another girl who joined her team and she didn't meet them for a year because, again, she had school drop-off. So by the time she got there, all the desks in the good part of the building were gone. And so she was always sitting half a floor or 2 floors away from them and going, I'm not meeting you. We're not having coffee together. We're not just chatting. So, you know, that's one of the casualties of what is otherwise a very compelling way of reducing real estate cost. And it's not untrue to say it can create human collision, you know, the whole you're going to bump into each other, you're going to chat, you'll have serendipitous conversations. That's not entirely fabricated.
No.
Now, whether it happens to the extent that it's described, we could probably debate that, but I don't think it doesn't happen at all.
No, I think those things can happen. I guess my point is the bullshit detectors have well and truly gone off by then. And look, one of the things I really like that, you know, you've just given two. Like when we think of change, you know, the great resignation and hybrid work, it's sort of change is huge. Change is going to be huge. You've just described, I think this is a really important point for listeners here too, particularly involved in change. The changes don't have to be huge changes to have a huge impact.
Yes.
On people, because what you've just described, I'll give you another great example, is when they look to an office relocation. I nearly went through one of them at my last employer where they were going to move us from in the city in a pretty swanky office, a part of the business, out to the western suburbs of Melbourne to our distribution centre. And look, I got to tell you though, there were some people who lived on the other side of the Westgate Bridge out in the western suburbs who were absolutely over the moon.
Yes.
That they wouldn't have to travel in anymore.
Yeah.
But there were people in the eastern suburbs that were like, this is going to put another 2 hours commute on for me every day, not to mention whatever else, whether there's tolls or other things that would come with it.
Mm.
This is another piece where I think organisations and managers just have to start to think about what's the impact on the individual here? And this comes back to my point before, trying to come up with a shit sandwich that's got hundreds and thousands on the outside of it so we can see it and go, well, that looks all right. I'm going to bite into that. And then I hope people aren't imagining this too much, but you've still got to bite through the turd. So back to the point of continuity and change, is it about changing the way we message change, do you think, would be valuable rather than just getting too caught up in big change has to occur?
Yeah, and I think that shift is gently happening as the bullshit detectors are alive and well. People are writing blogs, people are hitting social media. So organizations know they get killed if they put up shiny lipstick bullshit. You know, people will, you know, Dropbox famously got out a Pusheen cat as a way to say you pick up the Pusheen cat, which is a soft toy, and you pat it if you're feeling anxious in the meeting. right? Yep. And it went up on Twitter and it blew up as an example of, oh my God, this is Dilbert-esque, right? Yep. So, and I think social media has provided that pressure such that what you're describing, I think, is where it will drift. And so in your Westgate Bridge example, you'd have to stand up and say, look, it's a compelling real estate solution and it's going to be really inconvenient for some of you and it's going to be compelling for others of you. And we know we don't please everybody with this choice, speaking in those terms. And someone at the back of the room with their arms folded goes, okay, I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
You might then say, okay, it happens to suck for me because it now adds 2 hours to my commute. And, the candid response would be, and we know this, and we knew in advance that it would inconvenience a good percentage of you. And of course, you'll have a period of time to decide how it's going to work and if it's going to work. And we recognize there could be some conversations we can all have. But nonetheless, on the balance of everything, this is where we're going to go.
Yep. And we're going to go ahead and do it. So there it is. It's out there now. What we've also done is we've taken into account the impact that it's going to have both positively and negatively, but we're realistic about that. And it could well mean that some of you make some choices not to be here anymore. And we totally understand that as well. So I like the idea of being more open about change. And again, you would have seen, you'd be living in change with the work that you do, as I do. If people are looking to change, they don't get us in if they're wanting everything to be the same as what it is today. But how do we help them to realize that part of the continuity in staying the same way is the way that you communicate the change, and that we can't keep doing that? That might sound pretty simple, which leads me into the next little bit here, and I'm really interested in your thoughts on this is, I know I'm a pretty simple dude, so I sort of think the world's simple, but maybe I think too simply. But I also think we throw a whole lot of complexity and complication into things. And I say things, change being one of them, that could be simpler. I think we've come up with perhaps some simple things to do today. Your view on why, if you think this, that human beings try and at times make the simple over complicated or complex, if you think that?
Well, let's see. I think what we'd like to do is admire the problem.
Yep.
And you could argue you and I are doing a version of that right now, where a group will look at something and just enjoy commenting out loud to each other about the origins of how we got here and the various causal pathways that have, led to this point, versus the simpler, albeit probably more risky, pursuit of going, let's work on the problem. Because if I admire the problem and point out to you my penetrating insight on what I think led to us being in this place, typically, it doesn't involve me or anyone in the room. So it's, those last people who made the mistake and failed to realize early enough that we needed to change. So that's comforting. And then also, once we start to act on it, well, there's a chance it doesn't work. And then my name is on it because I had a go and it didn't work. And I think we overcredit and overblame managers for the performance of their organizations. I think when they go really well, it's not down to, people want to say Satya Nadella is why Microsoft is thriving. And you go, well, and that Steve Ballmer was a bad CEO. And, I go, that's probably not a fair reflection of Steve Ballmer's reign. He had some misses on his watch, but he also stood up the Microsoft Azure unit, right? So you go, well, that was on his time. It was early days, of course, so it wasn't the breakout success then that it has obviously become now. Jeff Immelt's a lovely thing to reference when you look at how he came in after Jack Welch. And he's like, I'm like the parent. You have to walk in and take away the punch bowl and switch off the music and say, get the bin out and clean this up. You've just been borrowing on a bender for 10 years.
Yeah.
So he goes, is that his doing or no? So why do we make it sophisticated? Because to actually act on these things is very difficult.
Yes.
And the chance of it not working is reasonable. So therefore, to answer your question, we'll make it more complex so it takes longer to talk about and we can fill ourselves up with the analysis and the reflection rather than the more simpler action of going, okay, let's try that. Bob, you're on. Go and give it a go. Let's come back here in 2 weeks, a month, 2 months and see where we are. At which point Bob's heart's in his throat because he's like, God, I might not actually be able to land that.
Yep.
And then what does that mean for me?
I like that, admiring the problem rather than working on it. And then the other thing they do is if they can't get either of those right, they just invite the consultants in.
Well, yeah, and you meet seasoned buyers of consulting, and I've met a couple over the years, and they're gorgeous because they're so dry and cynical about it all. They go, yeah, you said we hired two firms. We wanted one firm to write a report that said, do the M&A, and we wanted another firm to write a report that said, don't do the M&A. And we literally had both reports on the desk. And then based on whatever decision we thought we were going to make, we could then stand up and say, we're going with the insert gold-plated consulting house name recommendation. He said it literally was a political exercise to go, we've got both arguments ready. So if it goes to shit, as it often does, then we can say, well, you know, we were implementing the proposal as coined and penned by the consulting house who you'd respect and admire.
And I shouldn't just point out the big end of town here, because I think consultants are very good at this, but consultants, and I put myself in this space, we can skillfully practice the art of continuity pretty well. Because imagine if we made things change like we wanted them to change and then there was no work for us.
Yeah, I'm often surprised at consultants who complain about their clients. They go, oh, my client can't do this and they can't do this. And I'm going, okay, shut up. Like, what on earth are you doing? You should be grateful for the fact that they have a need for your services. Don't be so, I don't know, either pious or stupid.
I love it. Let's talk a bit about your business, 10,000 hours, where people can find you, what sort of things you get involved with, where they can sort of dig in a bit more into your business and work out whether or not there'd be some good humans there to work with.
Well, clients and others can be the judge, but look, we're a firm of, we're a facilitation agency, you might say, and we do two things. We help groups of people work on difficult problems together and work on their group dynamics. So we're hired frequently to work with ELTs or SLT teams who are either coming together. I've got a recent project at the moment, which is a startup with an aggressive timetable to IPO, and the team has just got to get its act together. And so, yep, I've, you know, been engaged to help in that conversation. We also do executive education. And, you know, I think we've found a niche for ourselves with sort of seasoned, cynical, been there, done that, hard to impress kind of audiences. And that's mainly because we've been around too. So we've, you know, we haven't seen it all. We've got the humility to know the damn thing is changing all the time. I mean, God knows it got flipped on us 12 months ago in terms of how we engage with clients and how, yep, we engage with groups. We all had that. And so, you know, 10,000hours.com, which is one with four zeros, hours.com is where you'll find us, and or you can find me on LinkedIn. And, you know, I'd love to have conversations if you've got leadership teams that are, you know, you're going, they're demanding, they're impatient, they'll rip the face off anything that isn't sort of to the point and hard hitting and straight shooting. We might be a worthwhile cup of coffee at a minimum.
Yeah, I like it. So dealing with those people in the room who usually sit there early on, Marcus, with their arms folded and their knuckles are white because they're like, here we fucking go again.
Yes.
And I also like the bit there about you and LinkedIn. I want to encourage the listeners, and you might get flooded with LinkedIn connection requests now. Don't try and sell him anything. Just connect with him, because one of the things that really appealed to me was just following the comments you write on other people's stuff and also what you put up yourself. But your commentary on other people's shares is just like, yep, I like that. There's a bit of velvet sledgehammer going on there. He's giving him a bit of a hit, but he's doing it with good intention. And I always find it quite enlightening and insightful, because you don't usually you see people say, I really love what you wrote. And it's like every now and again, someone needs to think of something a bit differently. So don't continue to love everyone. Maybe every now and again, give them something else. Mate, thanks for coming on board, and hope to catch up again soon.
Mark, thanks for having me. Good fun, good chat. Nice to do.
We love to admire rather than work on the problem. That was a bit of a mic drop moment for me when Marcus shared that around this idea of not going for the simple, but looking more at the complicated or the complex, is that if we sit around admiring the problem, we don't have to do anything. If we start to solve it and potentially the solution that we come up with doesn't work, well, then our name's to it. So we might be better off just continuing to talk about it, making it complex and complicated before we really get in and do the work. Just one of the fascinations that I picked up from today, you know, from someone with those 25 years of experience in working with, you know, large organisations, and as he sort of says now, they work with organisations that there's a bit of messiness there, and they need to work through that messiness, and they need to get to some systemic change, you know, in organisations. Our conversation about the Great Resignation, I guess how this podcast came about, we chatted a week or so ago, and then Marcus had commented on a comment I'd made on some research into the what's now being called the Great Resignation, and even the point today, like the big, the great, it's putting some of these words around, you know, the burning platform, using this language to build change up. When, as he sort of said today, that, you know, work is a little bit ho-hum. We go into work, we turn the lights on, we fire up the machines, we do what we need to do. So why is there this need to really, really, I guess, as we talked about, putting a bit of lipstick on the pig, jazzing it up a bit to make it like, here's the change. I loved our conversation around the idea that change doesn't necessarily have to be big to have a big impact. And the great examples that Marcus shared around, you know, those simple things that happened in that workplace with the intercompany envelope. And, you know, you can send that to me every day. I guess the law of unintended consequences, we're making this change because of these reasons. Well, you make it particularly hard for a particular demographic without really talking to them or hearing them or letting them be heard. And this can be the sort of thing that can happen. The conversations around the idea that we can sit in a room and come up with an idea of what the change should be and then water that down a little bit or put the hundreds and thousands on the shit sandwich. And why, as Marcus said, and I think he used a great example, why it's actually risky to senior leaders and to managers to tell the truth about change. But at the same time, there's a great bullshit detector that's listening at the other end that's just not buying what they're talking about. So I think that in itself is a bit of a lesson of where is the line between, you know, it's going to change and it has to change and these are the reasons why we're changing versus telling the truth. You know, one example we used today was hot desking, which seems to be, I think, driven by, I think, a very valid reason to reduce the real estate footprint and reduce costs. But we put the lipstick on the pig and we make it out to be that it's about collaboration and co-creation and all of this, these other sort of words that have crept their way into the business world. Really enjoyed sitting down with Marcus, really enjoyed his enthusiasm for the topic and also the very lateral way that he thought about things. I've certainly learned a lot from him today. Hey, if you like this, why not rate it 5 stars? And if you loved it, share it with your friends. But until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.